Two Designers Walk Into a Bar is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network.
For more information about our show or to discover more podcasts you'll enjoy, visit evergreenpodcasts.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah, a spittoon would make me happy.
Thing.
Yeah. What's? Yeah. Who's in charge of this spittoon cartel? How do we find a sponsor? You know, every good bar. If you watch an old western, every good bar always had a spittoon. So it's like, what do we need to do to get a spittoon in this bar? Who do we talk to about that?
Yeah. Really. The spittoon maiden.
The
matron.
Spittoon patrol.
The Spittoon Patrol.
Hey everyone, it's Elliot.
And Todd. Welcome to Two Designers Walk Into a Bar, an ongoing conversation about pop culture and iconic design.
There are some products so iconic that you know what they are as soon as you lay your eyes on them.
The color, the shape, or some other distinctive brand feature says, accept no substitute. There is no equal.
Today we're discussing a couple of products known the world over and the stories behind how they've become visually imprinted in our minds.
So ask the bartender for a top shelf liquor. Make sure that your 7-7 is actually made with 7-7.
And slide under the glowing PBR sign as we welcome you back into the bar. So, Todd, we've been working as designers for a while now. And I bring this up not to brag, but I feel we're people who have the benefit of being able to recognize certain patterns, right?
Yeah.
We don't plumb the depths of the quote-unquote business of design on this podcast, but, dear listener, indulge us for a moment, because if you've ever considered hiring a designer or a design team, I'm sure you've thought, is this worth it, right? So in other words, the ROI question.
Yeah, because people, good design ain't cheap, am I right?
It ain't.
High five.
So let's have some fun with this, okay? I'm going to provide an answer in the form of a quick story and ask that you try to guess, one, the name of the well-known company I'm talking about, and to the position of the person mentioned within that company, Todd. Okay? Do you think you can do this?
Oh, my God. This is like some Billy Goat Gruff stuff here,
okay.
Isn't it?
Look, don't sweat it, because I'm going to pepper this with some hints, okay?
All right. So we're talking about Billy Goats and Pepper.
All right. I would actually disregard both of those hints that you conjured up yourself, because they are in no way, shape, or form actually going to help you or anyone else, okay?
All right, so we're talking about a well-known company and the position of a person within that company.
Yes, who was responsible for a very distinctive design thing. Component that's associated with the brand. Okay.
All right. I got this. I feel good about this.
Okay.
And I know this company. You think I know this company?
Yes. If you don't know, okay. We've talked about this company before. There's no way.
Oh, hell. Okay.
Yeah. There's no way you don't know about this company. All right. Okay.
Is it Waffle House? Bing.
Waffle House. This product can be found within Waffle House.
Oh, okay. Well, you've narrowed it greatly. Okay. Please go ahead.
It's not maple syrup.
Oh, well, never mind.
It's not log cabin maple syrup.
It's not log cabin maple syrup. All right, great.
All right. So in 1915, a senior executive named Harold Hirsch wrote to his management team that they needed a new package for their product. Okay? So here you go. 1915. So this obviously is a company that's been around a while. I would argue even longer than Waffle House, which I don't think is about to turn 100 or whatever. So it wasn't simply an offhand suggestion, right? So he came to the table with some very specific ideas for this package. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So here's what he wanted to see. Here were his, traits, I guess, or his features. He wanted a distinctive appearance to fight generic substitutes in the marketplace. Okay.
Okay.
That's fair. Like, that's typical, right? Okay. But get this for the package. He wanted contours of this package, so the feel of this package, as well as the look, to be so unique that people would know the product by touching it, even in pitch black, like total darkness.
Wow. Okay.
All right. Okay. And then a shape, so the actual shape itself, when you could see it, that would be so iconic that it would be recognizable even when the package was broken into pieces.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. So that's not an easy creative brief.
No. Okay. Okay. All right. So is the product? All right, so let me do some. I feel like I'm on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire here. All right, so I'm going to talk to myself.
You're on Shark Tank, actually, but go ahead.
Yeah, okay, Shark Tank. All right. So it's not, the product isn't used in the dark necessarily. It just has to have a unique contour that, a person without sight could know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, now, okay. you could use it in the dark. There's nothing that says you can't use it in the dark.
Okay, is it a vibrator, Elliot?
Well, that's got a unique contour and a unique feel in the dark. But
now we're going to have to put an audience warning on this. Okay. All right. Let's get back to it. Sorry. All right. So let me do some deduction.
All right.
It's a package.
Go for it, Sherlock.
Sheer look.
It's a package. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And it's not a box because that's not necessarily a unique package shape that you could fill in the dark. I know about that time, just from, me being me, is...
Because you were born in 1915?
That's right. Well, actually, it would have to be probably more like 1900, because I'd be 15 to know this.
Oh, okay.
At that time, most products, they were not sold on shelves. You'd go into, a local grocer, and you'd like, I'd like 7 pounds of oats or whatever, and they would, scoop it out.
Yeah, Costco wasn't around in 1915.
Yeah. So this is kind of like the beginning of package design. Sounds like it was a food-related product because you said it was in Waffle House, and they have food there, I think.
They have delicious food there.
And it can be broken, which means it's, again, not a box. All right, so can I ask a question?
You just did.
Okay. Can I ask another specific question?
You just
about
did.
The product? Okay. Is it made of glass?
Okay. So you're zeroing in on this. I'm going to give you a few more hints. All right. You
ready? All right. Go ahead.
Okay. So the first one. The list of specifications that I mentioned a minute ago were given to the Root Glass Company, so Root Glass Company, for final design and production. So that's going to narrow it down, definitely, right? So broken into pieces, that kind of thing. Okay. The resulting package shape, the contours that we talked about in the silhouette, was inspired by one of the main product ingredients, which is the African cola nut. Okay.
I think I know.
Here's the clincher. I think you'll get it if you're I think you're zeroing in, but the glass used for the final package, it wasn't clear. It actually has a subtle green tint.
Right. We're talking about Coca-Cola, the Coke bottle.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yep. Yeah. So you figured it out.
Iconic.
Yeah.
Oh. No other product like that.
No, not
no other
at
product
all.
Package, I
yeah.
should say.
Yeah, well, no other product either. Remember the tragedy that was New Coke and then the subsequent? Yeah. Dear listeners, we talk about New Coke in our Pepsi episode and the Pepsi Challenge, and go back and listen to that if you... There's a tale there. There's a tale we weave, yeah.
Yeah, there's a morality play there. There's a lesson to be learned. There's like an Aesop's fable of that.
So it's the Coca-Cola bottle, the distinctive contoured glass bottle with the fluted sides, the bulging middle. So how iconic is this, Todd? You just mentioned a second ago, it's very iconic. So Coke conducted a study back in 1949, and they found that less than 1% of the population in the U.S. could not identify the bottle based on the shape alone. So not looking at the logo, not, you know, sort of like this Rorschach test, like, hey, what is this thing? And people would just look at it, you know, this silhouette, and they'd say, oh, yeah, that's a Coke bottle, right? So the bottle was so important to the company that rather than continuing to renew patents, which is something I didn't know. I thought, like, once you got a patent, it was patented, right? Continuing to renew these patents, they actually went ahead and trademarked it in 1961. So, all right. Boom, right? So now it's sort of all time.
Well, roughly like 40 years.
Yeah.
40 years they were renewing patents.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about that. Okay, so Coke may have been a fairly easy guess, right? So, Coke, fine. But we still haven't talked about the guy. So who was Harold Hirsch? My note about the trademark may help define his role at Coke.
Okay.
He wasn't the CEO. Like, you would have heard of him, I think, if he had been
That's
CEO.
What I would have guessed. Yeah.
So, but here's the other thing. He wasn't their head of marketing.
Okay.
In fact, this guy had no marketing training at all. So what do you think his role was in the company?
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm going to, given those hints, my first guess would have been CEO. Second guess would have been head of marketing. I'm going to say head of logistics, transportation.
So he would have been in charge of bottling.
Yeah.
Okay. Nope. He was not in charge of bottling. Guess again.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't in charge of, like, the bottle caps. He wasn't like the guy. You do the glass part, and I'll do the metal part.
Okay. Then, given kind of his requirements, makes me think he had something to do with intellectual property, like trademarking or something.
Ah, you're getting very, very close. Okay.
All right.
He was the company's legal counsel.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he was their head lawyer. So why would a lawyer advocate for distinctive packaging? I mean, to your point a moment ago, that's really the domain of marketing. Like, why would this guy care what it looked like?
Yeah.
So there were a few reasons for this. First, as we've talked about with the iconic bottle, it made Coca-Cola's presentation very familiar to people. Like you said, this was before stores.
Right.
So Coke was served in soda fountains.
Mm-hmm.
They actually put these glasses, you know, Coke would supply a lot of, like they do today with restaurants, they would supply these soda fountains with all kinds of marketing and glasses and all of these other, you know, marketing materials that that would help carve out when you were getting a Coke versus when you were getting a generic equivalent, right?
Right.
So they give you these glasses that they serve the Coke in that look like the bottle. So there's this connection because the glass is made from the same material. They have that same fluting, so the same touch, right? And then, as I mentioned a second ago, there were other generic equivalents. This was a very, very fragmented landscape over 100 years ago. You know, if you go to someplace like a Cracker Barrel, you always see these crazy regional cola signs, these old ads on the walls, and you're like, what are these? I've never heard of these. Where did these come from?
Right.
So 100 years ago, these were all over the place. So soda fountains weren't beholden to just Coke or just Pepsi. There were a lot of regional actors that were, you know, also trying to get a buck.
Yeah.
And then the unique appearance was ownable, right? So we talked about this idea of it being a trademark, right? They went from patenting this thing to finally just saying, we're going to file a trademark and it's going to be ours and it's going to be done.
Yeah.
Going back to this question, like, is design worth the investment? I would say the answer is yes, because over 100 years later, so this was 1915, you know, we're talking, what, 100, I'm bad at math, 109 years, I think, later.
Yeah.
And Coke's bottle still meets all the original criteria, and it's an important brand anchoring element across the globe, right? Everybody knows what this thing looks like.
Yeah.
Today, it's made from plastic a lot of the times, of course. So, you know, as it continues to expand.
And let me add, too, I would even say, if you look at some retail environments where it's served, you know, in a fountain, so it actually comes in a, you know, a bag of syrup and a canister of carbonated water is mixed with it.
Like a Coke Freestyle machine or something like
that. Right. But they actually use the silhouette of the bottle as kind of a symbol for the product, along with the wave and the script and all that other stuff. So
yeah.
You could actually see, which is kind of funny when you think about it. It's a little meta. Like, here's a shape of a bottle that used to carry this product, which is now a bag of syrup. You know,
or it's on the cup, right? You get a cup that you fill, and it's a picture of a bottle on a cup.
Yeah.
Which I think is amazing. But that goes back to that profile thing, right? So people today will still know that Rorschach test or whatever. People will still know, oh, that's a Coke bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
This bottle definitely got some accolades just outside of the beverage industry. It's been so noteworthy that over the years it was called, quote unquote, the perfect liquid wrapper by Raymond Loewy. He's a guy you may have heard of, industrial designer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he designed the Lucky Strike package. He designed locomotives.
He did a thing or two.
I think he went on to do some things. And it was included in artwork by Todd, your buddy, Andy Warhol.
Andy loved Coke.
As a representation of mass culture. Yeah, he absolutely loved Coke. And it's been compared to the Beetle by Volkswagen as this iconic thing, totally anchored to a company, a specific company.
Yeah.
So not a bad group to be a part of, I think.
No, I would agree. Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, one additional takeaway from the story is the notion that great ideas can come from anywhere, right? This came from a lawyer.
Yeah.
And opportunities can present themselves in non-traditional forms. So this is a moment where sometimes a crisis, in this case, counterfeit products, right? These non-cola Cokes, they're passing off as Coke, or at least the public thinks it's Coke, can lead to an incredible result, right? This global recognition through this iconic bottle. Okay, Todd. One last nugget,
right.
And I'm going to dangle this in front of you, it in front of the listeners.
Ooh, dangling a nugget.
Do you know who came up with Coke's name and distinctive logo?
I don't know who came up with the name. I just assumed it was the founder.
Nope, it wasn't the founder.
I do know that the distinctive script logo was done by an employee.
Yes.
But I don't know what that employee's job was.
It was a guy named Frank Robinson, and he was their bookkeeper.
He probably was not the Coke calligrapher, right?
No, well, he ended up being the Coke calligrapher because it was his handwriting. Like, it was he wrote at the top of his, you know, these ledger pages and things like that. So that's totally, you know, the sort of John Hancock, if you will, of Coca-Cola came from their accountant. So their bottle came from their lawyer and their logo came from their accountant. But, you know, we could spend the rest of the time talking about Coke, Todd. That is another story for another day.
Oh, man. Yes. And a cool story and certainly iconic. And, you know, you're talking about Coke, Elliot, such a bar staple. It's literally everywhere.
Everywhere. You know, Todd, I don't see any of it in front of me right now. Not only that, but rum and rocks also seems to be missing from my tumbler. And, you know, a cherry if the bartender happens to have it.
Anything else, Your Majesty?
As long as you're up, you may as well get one for yourself, too.
You're generous, Elliot. Overly generous.
Well, I try, Todd.
All right. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about some more iconic product packaging.
Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the professional book nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like, how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always,
happy reading!
Hi, we want to take a moment to mention that if you're enjoying this episode, we have an archive of topics ranging from the Olympics to movie posters.
Think Ghostbusters.
Iconic images.
Think Bigfoot.
Punk music.
The Ramones.
Saturday morning cartoons.
The Pink Panther.
And failed products like OK Soda. Visit our website at twodesignerswalkintoabar.com for full episode notes and visuals, the latest blog content, and to sign up for our newsletter.
Follow us on social media. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Find the links on our website or search using the phrase Two Designers Walk Into a Bar.
Most importantly, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people like you find podcasts like this.
And tell a friend about us. Send them a link to our podcast from your listening platform of choice.
And if you're inclined, buy our merchandise. Stickers, coasters, magnets, t-shirts. We're designers. We make good stuff, and it helps support the show.
Get in touch. Use the contact form on our website or send an email to hello@twodesignerswalkintoabar.com.
We read every message we get. Honest.
And we're available for speaking gigs. Email us to learn more.
Okay, now back to the bar. So we just learned about the origins of the iconic Coke bottle.
Yep.
And there's actually, I'm sorry?
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
So. Are you all right? I mean.
That's exactly what I was thinking, that you had said something important, Elliot.
Yep.
Yep. All right. So I actually had been thinking about an iconic product as well. And mine is also a beverage. It also is a glass bottle. So there must be something.
Is it Pine Sol?
Damn it. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We'll see you on the next episode. No, all right, but let me start by asking you a question. I know the answer to this. I think I know the answer to this. Have you ever found inspiration in unusual places?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Yeah, like bookstores, flea markets, maybe?
All the above, yeah. Bookstores, record stores, flea markets. I mean, just driving along the road like we talked about in our...
Road signs, yeah.
Yeah, road signs. You pull off, you take pictures of cool things. Yeah, I think as designers, we're collectors of the physical, but we're also collectors of the visual.
Yeah,
I mean, thank goodness we have cameras on our phones, right?
Yeah. Good point. Because we're always kind of snapping up that inspiration. I did yesterday, as a matter of fact. I was driving past something, and I was like, that would be great for a thing. So that's what this story is basically about. You talked about the kola nut from Africa being the inspiration for the Coke bottle.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about, and I'll get into some of the inspiration in just a second, but I'm talking about a product considerably younger than Coke.
Okay.
And it was introduced in 1979, and I'm talking about the Absolut Vodka bottle. You know what I'm talking about? I bet you could draw that as easily as you could draw the Coke bottle.
Probably easier. It's more streamlined.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, right? That was part of the design concept for the Absolut bottle, as a matter of fact. And pre-apologies to all of our listeners in Sweden. These are the guys that were in charge of the design concept. So if I butcher your name, I apologize. You can certainly call us up and butcher my name too. It won't be too bad. But the guys in charge of the design concept, it was a company called Carlson and Broman, and led by a guy named Hans Brinfors, Gunnar Broman, and Lars Bjorg Carlson. Is that how you pronounce that? Is that how you would say B?
Well, and is umlaut R J E. Borg.
Yeah, I don't know what's the J E. Borgia.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I would say maybe Borg. It's not like Borge.
All right. Well, we'll write this down in the notes, and let's just call them Hans, Gunnar, and Lars right now.
I like that. Weren't those the members of Nelson?
I thought it was the Pep Boys, but you might be right. Okay. So Carlson and Broman was the name of the design company. And this what happened was this public company in Sweden called Vin and Sprit came to them. Vin and Sprit, which is actually Vin and Sprit is short for Vin and Sprit Centralen, which is basically like government-owned wine and spirits retail business in Sweden.
Okay, interesting.
All right, and let me just clarify. I'm saying sprit, not spit, okay? So don't get any ideas about the vodka with that.
Or the spittoon we talked about earlier.
That's right. That's right. So this government-owned body, they were looking to develop a premium vodka because they needed to boost sales for exports, particularly exports to the U.S. market, because, you know, Sweden had vodka, but it wasn't really, Sweden wasn't really known for vodka, right?
Right. Russia was known for vodka, yeah.
That's right. So thus, Vin & Sprit came to the design company of Hans, Gunnar, and Lars there. And they were actually, so they're actually on this little island called Reimersholme, and it's in central Stockholm. And that's where the original vodka guy, L.O. Smith, started his quest for what he called, I'm going to do quotes here, absolutely pure vodka. He started that in the 1870s. So he was actually a little bit older than Coke.
Yeah. Okay. So so we're talking, this package is over 100 years after the product existed.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
109 years, actually. Yeah.
Crazy. Okay.
And the product was derived from the name that he called this. It was called Absolut Rent Brennevin. Sorry. Let me say that last word again. Because again, apologies to the Swedes, and apologies to the Swiss
the
for
Swiss.
Calling them Swedes. It was Absolut Rent Brennevin.
What, Todd? Let's do the English. What does that translate to?
Okay, good. Thank you. Whew. I have a considerably easier time with this. It means absolute pure vodka, so
Got
to speak.
It.
Okay, because at the time, so back to 1979, or flash forward to 1979, Mr. L.O. Smith, he's been making vodka for 100 years, and then this government agency said, you know, we got to do something different. We got to sell a premium vodka. It's got to be distinct. It's got to be different. How are we going to do that? Well, how about the packaging of it? And up until then, you know, you can probably guess what vodka packaging looked like. It was tall, sort of thin bottles. They had large red labels on them, lots of crests and lots of Russian sounding names and things like that, right?
Sure, Stolichnaya, that kind of stuff.
Right, right. So they were red, like bottles were red and, you know, tall and strong looking.
So this begs a question, Todd. So Sweden's colors, last time I checked, I was looking in the file here. You know, we love flags and we love things like this, the Olympics and so forth. Sweden's colors are yellow and blue.
That's
so
true.
Why red labels? On my color wheel, yellow and blue are not anywhere close to red.
Right, right. Well, so even in Sweden, vodka packaging was red because it was so closely associated with Russia. So quality vodka equaled Russian vodka.
Okay.
Up until the time when Absolut were launching their new bottles. So I asked you about inspiration earlier.
Yep.
This is a story about inspiration because one of the guys that we were talking about, Gunnar Broman, actually found inspiration for the Absolut bottle in a Stockholm antique shop. He found this 18th century apothecary bottle and thought it was really cool. It was fairly simple. It was squatty, and took that as the design inspiration for the Absolut bottle. And incidentally, even in the 16th and 17th centuries, alcohol was sold in pharmacies as medicine.
You know what, Todd? My medicine's getting a little low right now.
Okay, yeah, okay. Well, I'm not done with my story yet, so you got to wait just a second. Although it seemed kind of unusual to find that inspiration, this bottle that he found, it was kind of stout, a little bit squatty. So what they did, this design firm, is they kind of zagged when all the other Russian vodkas were zigging. They made it, you know, it's a rounded top. It's got a little bit of a stubby neck to it. They print directly on the bottle. There are no labels. So it's like, if I'm sure you've seen this, it's their smaller black type.
Yep.
Describes the Swedish heritage. And this bottle, it was new and it was bold. And like I said, no label. It was basically, it was transparent. It was meant to capture the look of Sweden and the feeling of purity and transparency and authenticity.
Yeah, and the absolute type, like the actual brand is sort of Sweden's blue, right?
Yeah, it is. And that was really the only color, which is really kind of counter when you think about what a product should be doing. It usually is trying to scream at you from a shelf, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, you're talking about this bottle, you're talking about it's clear, it has this clear, I think it's sort of this, not to get too designy here, but I think it's sort of this idea of essential form, right? It's this just streamlined, if it's thinking about how it's presented, it's like, this is the essence of this beverage, so imagine, you know, we have nothing to hide, we're not embellishing this in any way, so you're going to get bar patron, you're going to get something very pure and delicious. And, you know, it's sort of like the snow that melted into this glacial water that ran right into this bottle. You know what I mean? It's very romantic. It's very Scandinavian in that regard.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Really conceptually works, right? But think about what a product its bottle is supposed to do. It's supposed to grab attention. It's supposed to be unique. So it had no printing on the bottle. The bottle was completely transparent. So it had a lot of detractors. It was basically a magnifier for other brands when it sat on a shelf.
Yeah, it's the anti-bottle, right?
Yeah, you saw right through it, right? So because it was so highly unusual without the label and hardly any color at all, aside from the title, as you said, was in sort of Sweden blue.
And it was really bold. It's in this like heavy Futura, this condensed Futura. So this really bold, sans serif, modern looking typeface. So, I mean, that was really the only thing that stuck out on the shelf.
Right. You saw this basically this blue floating or these two blue floating words on a shelf. So even among the detractors, it kind of resounded. It was there. They did do some minor modifications back then as it got out into the wild because they found the neck of the bottle was a little too stubby and bartenders were dropping bottles because they couldn't get a good grip on it, you know?
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
They extended the neck a little bit off of it, but...
I mean, Todd, how are you supposed to do your cocktail dance where you're twirling the bottles, throwing them
you
up in the air and catching them.
You can't get a
good
spin.
Yeah, you can't. It's just, I mean, that, I don't know about you, but to me, that's the hallmark of a good bar.
If you can do a good cocktail behind the back spin, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You nailed it right there. So we talk a lot in some of our past episodes about the glory that was Studio 54, and Absolut has a little bit of history and was kind of built from that as well.
I mean, perfect timing, 1979.
Yeah, yeah. The CEO of the importer, a guy named Michel Roux, his company's name was Carillon, used to spend a lot of time at Studio 54 hanging with who else? His buddy, Andy Warhol, right?
Yeah.
And because of that, there was some buzz created about this new cool vodka, sort of trendy vodka. Andy even did some paintings of the bottle for advertising back in like the mid-80s.
So he cut his teeth painting the Coke bottle, and then he transitioned to Absolut.
So he was doing vodka and Coke. Oddly enough, just half-second sidebar there, that sort of started other artists working with Absolut on their advertising. So like... Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf, plenty of others.
Like our Swatch collaborations we talked about in our prior episode.
Right. So, oddly enough, the bottle actually won first prize at the Art Directors Club of New York in 1980.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so it was recognized, you know, for its sort of purity and simple of design. But a few seconds ago, we were just talking about the blending of the art and the product. And you can't really talk about the Absolut bottle without talking about the advertising.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that, right?
Yes. It really is what made the bottle iconic because those ads went on, I just remember, for years and years and years. And I think there's actually a book that compiles a lot of those ads. if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're completely right. TBWA was the ad agency. They started running ads in like 1981 in New York Magazine.
Okay.
And, you know, right in smack in the middle of the New Wave period, which, you know, we've talked about in a couple episodes. And I think there was a lot of influence of that as well. And they used the bottle as the hero.
Yep.
And we'll post some examples if you haven't seen these. But it is exactly that. It starts with, you know, the bottle shape, and then they add a little thing here and a little thing there to it. And let me ask you a trivia question.
All right.
Do you remember the first iconic Absolut bottle ad?
I think I do, actually.
All right.
Okay, let's see if I can remember.
So
this.
Before you, well, give you a second to guess, but before that, remember all of the ads said Absolut and then blank. There was a thing that related to the image.
The ads worked because just like the vodka bottle and everything we talked about a minute ago, it was really just sort of this essential form. Like they always approached the advertising as if the product was already established and iconic,
right,
which was
right,
brilliant,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
So you'd look at these ads and you're like, huh, like I should know about this. Like you almost felt if you didn't know about it that you're like, well, obviously these people are, you know, they're behaving as if they've already arrived, so they must know something I don't.
Right? That's exactly what happened in the U.S. It was promoted as, you're missing this cool European trend. All right, so I gave you a second there. Can you remember the first ad?
Okay. So, Todd, I'm going to use context clues
that
you already talked about.
Go ahead, Sherlock.
Well, we talked about the see-through bottle. We talked about how it hardly had anything on it.
Mm-hmm.
You have this clear glass bottle. You have this clear liquid inside of it. We talked about this idea of, like, glacial runoff into this bottle. So this cleanliness, I'm going to say, if I remember, because this was an iconic ad. Now, I don't know if this was the first ad.
Okay. All right.
But wasn't it the bottle with a halo over it and the headline was Absolut Purity?
Well, I'll give you 1 point for getting it half right.
Okay.
You're exactly right. It was the iconic Absolut bottle with just a halo added to it, and the headline was Absolut Perfection.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay, I was close.
No, yeah. You did great. So that was sort of the style. They began by just the bottles with a little addition to it here and there. And then it sort of stretched out to almost like, where's Waldo? It's like, find the Absolut bottle in the image.
Yes.
Because they started showing cities like Absolut New York, Absolut LA.
Which was Central Park shaped like
right,
the,
and Absolut LA, which was like a pool, a rooftop pool. And Absolut Chicago, which had the label being blown off of it.
Yeah, Windy City. Yep.
Yeah, and so... All right, another question for you. Can just wild guess, do you happen to know how many ads they used with the bottle as the hero? I'll tell you this. I'll give you a hint. The campaign ran for more than 25 years.
Okay. 25 years. I remember, like I said, that there was a book made. So 25 years, I remember, I mean, it's a coffee table book, but it's not like it was like a set of encyclopedias or
something.
So it must've just been a sort of, 25 years though. I mean, gosh, hundreds. I mean, 1,000.
You're closer with thousands. A little over 2,000 ads were made with bottle as a hero. So,
is that globally? Like, in other words, like when this caught on in the U.S., this iconic thing, did Absolut then carry that over in other parts of the world?
I don't know the answer to that because I think it has something to do with the distributor was probably responsible for the advertising in the U.S., Carillon. So I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah, and the reason I asked that is because it was so essential and so minimal.
Right, right.
You really don't have these language barriers.
Yeah, true, true.
There were all the sort of these visual puns. So you would think that you could do, you know, whatever, like Absolute Tokyo, and it could be like Godzilla's, you know, climbing up the bottom or something.
Right, right.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. If you understood the word absolute, which, you know, was the product also, so it would translate. It was pretty easy to understand.
Yeah, it wouldn't be changed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I was just curious.
Yeah, it might make sense. Anyway, the risk of this completely worked. And in just a few years after the launch, just 6 years after the launch in 1985, Absolute overtook Stolichnaya as the top-selling vodka import in the U.S.,
and Stolichnaya.
Stolichnaya. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me say it. Thank you.
You
well,
just say Stoli. Yeah,
let's just say you said it, okay? Because I said Stolichnaya. Stolichnaya. I like the way you said it. I won't redo it.
This is it, folks. This is the raw bar conversation.
It is. It is. If you're hearing this, we didn't edit it out. Yes. Stolichnaya was the top-selling vodka import in the U.S.
And Todd's had three or four absolutes prior to recording.
I did. And a couple Stolies.
Part of the reason he can't pronounce Stolichnaya.
And really, in just 10 short years, the Absolute factory actually tripled in employees. So demand
Holy smokes.
There.
So the U.S. became, was the U.S. its biggest single market then?
Yes.
It sounds like?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's why the product was developed. You remember in the beginning, like it was developed for export to the U.S.
All right. Excellent.
So just as we wrap up, a couple little things. I saw this analysis in this publication called Retail Brews, and it was like, why did it work? Well, they said it worked for exactly the reason the detractors said it wouldn't work, which is silhouette is everything in the spirits space, because if you're sitting at a bar,
right,
you can't read the label from a, you know, if you're sitting, you know, in front of the bar and the alcohol, rightfully so, should be behind the bar away from you.
And the more you drink, Todd, the harder it is to read those labels.
You can't read it, so the silhouette is everything.
Or pronounce the labels.
if it's Stoli, I forget it, if it's Stoli. Now, let me just do a quick little update here. There was a slight update in 2021.
Uh-huh.
Not to the bottle shape exactly, but just slightly bigger logotype, a little more simple, clear typography, and they embossed the bottles with a phrase, made in Sweden. So,
okay.
You know, it's not drastic. They kept the DNA of it, of course. But kind of cleaned it up a little bit. And again, the most important thing, though, I think, is that they kept the iconic shape of the bottle.
Oh, absolutely. Oops. No pun intended.
Hey-oh!
But speaking of vodka, Todd, we've been talking beverages, vodka, mm-hmm. Coke. gives me an idea.
Oh, here we go.
So I think you should go to the bar, mm-hmm. check to make sure that the Absolute bottle is featured where it needs to be on the shelf. That okay. they have some Coke at the ready.
Okay.
And then magically, you can come back with some fresh drinks.
So that would be absolute magic, wouldn't it?
For me, it would.
Hey, okay. All right. Well, I guess I owe that to you for sitting through that last pun.
Yeah, we're going to have a big bar tab with all the listeners having to have sat through it, too.
I know. Yeah. You know, we should have made that a drinking game, shouldn't we? Any bad joke?
No, I'm sure these people have been drinking this whole time.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
See you soon.
See you soon.
Bonjour. This is Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. I'm Andrew Pryor, and every week I bring you the wonderful and fabulous people involved in French food, whether they're here in France like me or from around the world. Each week, we dive into a specific topic, be it a French dish, an ingredient, or a French cuisine cooking technique. My guests are all about French food. So come join me on Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. Bon app.
Two Designers Walk Into a Bar is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network.
For more information about our show or to discover more podcasts you'll enjoy, visit evergreenpodcasts.com.